Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today I'm joined by Vivian Dittmar, and we're going to be talking about her book, The Emotional Backpack, which has recently been translated into English. So today we're going to be talking about the conscious release process that Vivian has created, which is really a process to release past conditioning parts of us that were formed when we were young. So we'll go deep into how that process works and how our emotional work can relate to our journey from ego to a healthy sense of self to a transcendent self, and how that relates to what Vivian calls the inner order and transrational ways of knowing. Vivian is an author, a wisdom teacher, and founder of Be the Change Foundation. Through her books, lectures, seminars, and online offerings, she has been committed to a holistic development of people, society, economy, and consciousness for over two decades. And her books include The Emotional Backpack, The Power of Feelings, and Your Inner GPS. I highly recommend checking out my earlier conversation where we went deeper into transrational ways of knowing. So that all being said, let's dive in. All right, Vivian, it's great to be with you again. How do I find you today? How are you doing?
Andrea, so good to see you again. I'm very excited to continue our conversation, our dialogue. I remember last time we really managed to touch on some precious points. I'm kind of in between letting go of a phase of intense work and diving into the inner space from which I generate my books, and yeah, almost at the point of writing another one, but that, we'll talk about that when it's there. Yes, I'm kind of in an in-between space, and I like that. So that's how I'm here today.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I really enjoyed our last conversation. And so I'm sure we'll kind of start to touch into some of the points from there. And weaving in, we're going to talk about The Emotional Backpack today, which is a book of yours that got translated into English. And I think there's some really beautiful kind of teachings and distinctions in there. And we can connect some of the emotional work that you suggest with transrational ways of knowing and, you know, this journey we can make from ego to a healthy self to a transcendent sense of self as well later in the conversation. So actually I'd just love to kind of like start from the beginning and ask you about in a sense, like what's the premise of this book. I know it starts with a really nice distinction between feelings and emotions, which I think is important, and you know, it's helping us to relate to our emotions and process our emotions. So I think the first question I want to ask really is could you give us like a sense of why you wrote this book, why you think it's important? And I know at the beginning you make this really beautiful distinction between feelings and emotions. So yeah, let's kind of build from the foundation up. Yeah.
Sure. I wrote the book because on my own path, I observed that my own inability to deal appropriately with emotional baggage really caused me to have significant problems personally and in my relationships, privately and professionally. Like, it was affecting my whole life. And it took me a while to figure out what it was. And it took me even longer to find out how to deal with it in a way that is profoundly transformative and actually in line with the spiritual path that I was walking since a very early age. And once I discovered how to do that, which was through a practice, the practice of conscious release, which is what the book is basically about, I noticed how it profoundly transformed every aspect of my life. And it was like the missing link for me to ground and actually live and implement and act on all the kind of lofty ideals and spiritual insights and whatnot that I'd had, which before, like, they were all there, but I couldn't live it. I mean, we all know those moments when we know we would want to behave differently and we just can't, right? And that's what I call like the emotional backpack acting up, where some part of us that we haven't processed often immature parts, very hurt parts, traumatized parts, suddenly like gets in the way of who we really want to be and who on a certain level we actually are, but we haven't integrated that to like all of us. So discovering that for myself and then looking at society and looking at the people I was working with, I realized, oh my God, like this is huge. And it's like everyone's kind of overlooking it, sidestepping it, trying to avoid it, hoping it'll just go away. And with everyone, I mean, like whether you are looking at people on a spiritual path, whether even in psychology, a lot of psychologists are really scared of feelings, or in philosophy or the business world, or it's like everywhere, people are just trying to avoid this because it's uncomfortable and it's where the rubber hits the road in many ways. So I realized it was like this elephant in the room. And I wrote the book and I was amazed at what rose out of it, like how a whole community of practice was formed around it, of people like practicing this and reporting very, very similar things in their own life, and reporting how what we often strive to achieve through meditation, for example, which is to quiet the mind, actually for many people finally happens consistently when they practice conscious release, because the emotional fuel that runs a lot of the mental activity, the unhealthy mental activity, is actually then released and no longer running the show. So yeah, that's like just, it's a very personal thing initially. And by now it no longer is, because it's no longer running my life. But as it happens for many of us, when we discover something this valuable, we want to make it available to others and help them alleviate their own suffering. Yeah,
beautiful. Yeah, before we get into conscious release and some of the distinctions you make around emotions, I think that point you're making about, you know, you were on a spiritual path and you felt you were getting hijacked. I think it's so important. I've heard other people talk about this too, that like we had John Churchill on the podcast, how, you know, he was just saying the same, a similar thing, that what takes people out of the places that they access in meditation are the parts, the, you know, the unresolved attachment issues, and that's where our focus of attention gets sucked back into. So we can access these, we can open and begin to explore these states and different ways we can be in the world, and then suddenly it's like in the midst of daily life sucked back in. Like, yeah, that sounds like that was the case for you too. You were noticing that dynamic.
Exactly. Yes. And also, I mean, I became a mother very early. So you know what that's like, parenting. I mean, it's nothing like parenting to get you in touch with your trigger points and your limitations. And yeah, so that's exactly what happened for me. And what I noticed is that initially, of course, I tried to do what everyone tries, which is to try to get back to that blissful state where everything is fine as quickly as possible. And I realized that didn't really work. And I eventually realized that the very points I was avoiding were actually huge opportunities to really transform and to really grow and develop the kind of wisdom in life and not just in some transcendent realm that I was actually longing for.
Yeah. So how can we begin to do that, really? And this might be where you could also just lay the groundwork for conscious release by maybe, I liked the distinction you made between feelings and emotions and the different layers of emotions or the different layers we can have in our backpack. So yeah, what do we need to know about emotions before we can actually approach releasing them? Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Let's start with that distinction between feelings and emotions. I feel that's crucial. And it's also not common. Like, it's not that everyone uses the terms in this way. It's a distinction I choose to make. And I use emotions for unresolved feelings from the past. So stuff that we haven't felt, experiences we haven't processed. That's what I specifically use the term emotion for. So emotions are actually something very normal, very common. We all have them, but not really healthy. It's something that we want to heal. Whereas feelings is something, can be something completely healthy. And this is a point that I really emphasize. There is feelings such as anger, sadness, shame, fear that a lot of people also avoid because they're considered unhealthy, or we think they're unhealthy, they're uncomfortable, but they can actually be very, very healthy. We need those feelings in order to live as humans, in order to relate to each other. We need them in their mature, evolved form, which is something I wrote a whole nother book about, The Power of Feelings. But this distinction is so important because what most people do is that they think of like positive and negative feelings, and the positive feelings is basically flavors of joy, and negative feelings is everything else. And the problem with that approach is that flavors of joy basically is what we have when things are the way we want them to be, which of course is wonderful. But as we know, especially once we've been around for a couple of decades, that that's not always the case, right? Like, I mean, there's a lot of situations in life where there is that famous gap between what we would like and what actually is, and that gap we can call pain. And then we can try not to have it and go into suffering, which is very common these days. We fight the gap, or we can actually rely on our healthy, mature feeling powers, as I like to call them, to engage with that gap between what we would like and what is. And so that's very important for me to be clear that there are very healthy expressions of anger. Anger can be very appropriate, can help us to get things done. It can help us to take a stand for our values, to actually fight for certain causes that are in line with our hearts, our spiritual paths, our the evolution, the evolutionary step that we are trying to take and need to take as a species. And the same thing goes for the other feelings. I'm not going to go into it too deeply because there's, as I said, a whole book about it. But just to be clear that it's very important for me to emphasize that even the so-called negative feelings are necessary and have evolved for a reason. And part of our task is to actually evolve them in ourselves to a mature expression so that they can have their appropriate place. And in order to do that, we need to distinguish them from emotions, which are those unprocessed, immature, unhealthy expressions that we all carry around with us in our emotional backpack and that occasionally get triggered. And very often, of course, they get triggered when there's a gap between what we would like and what actually is. But then instead of like going into a healthy, mature response, we become emotionally activated, which is how I like to call that. And we suddenly are like immature, irrational. We lose our sense of agency. We can no longer really relate to the world and each other and ourselves the way we would like. It's basically a loss of control that we experience. And this is very, very frustrating. We lose our ability to connect, to resonate, to listen, and to be the people we want to be. And learning to recognize this state is like a first step and a very, very important step on the path of emotional healing, because usually when we go into these states, we try to deny it. We try to pretend it's not there. I hope it'll just go away. And of course, it doesn't really. And even if it does eventually go away, often we use very unhealthy strategies to make that happen. A lot of our addictions are founded in this. And that doesn't mean it's going to be resolved, right? It's just stuffed back into the backpack. And what I'm proposing is to basically go right in. So when this kind of thing comes up, to create a space that supports us in confronting, feeling, releasing, and healing the very parts in us that are actually waiting for that. For a long time, they're waiting to be felt, they're waiting to be healed, they're waiting to be integrated. Those life experiences are waiting to be integrated. And the practice of conscious release is a setting which allows us to do this very reliably and safely and effectively.
So I'm hearing like the first step, of course, is just recognizing when these emotions are arising, and then to feel those. And I wonder if it's important for you that like in things like internal family systems or other approaches, what I think is really beautiful about those is they invite this like disidentification from the innocent, in a part or an emotion, so that I can then be with that part and emotion from a very different place, a place that can welcome or allow that emotion to be here. Do you think that's important? Because there are other, I mean, I guess like disidentification from it is always important, because that's, otherwise we're really gripped by the trigger. But there are other approaches which really invite us to feel, to become, almost become the emotion rather than be
Yeah.
with it. Yeah.
And that's a very interesting point. So initially, the practice of conscious release is very much a practice that invites you to feel whatever wants to be felt. And we do not initially focus on disidentifying for the simple reason that my observation has been that if you try to head directly for disidentification, you very often end up in spiritual bypassing. You end up in just being like, okay, it's not me, but that in itself doesn't change it, right? So, excuse my language, but you might be an asshole and then you're just not identified with being an asshole. And that might be nice for you, but your environment is not going to be very happy about that. And we've seen lots of examples of that. So, what we do is in the practice of conscious release is we actually encourage people to feel what wants to be felt. But we do that in a very particular setting. We never do that alone. And we always do it with a partner who holds space for us from a very compassionate, transpersonal place in their hearts. And this has a very interesting effect. It supports you to fully give space to your immaturity and everything that's coming up in the context of a very different consciousness. And that leads to a very effective processing and release, which eventually does lead to a disidentification. But it's not this disidentification of like, oh, that's not me, which we often try to do. But when we try to bypass that step of actually feeling it, it's a disidentification that happens very natural. It's like that old metaphor of the fruit falling from the tree when it's ripe. It's like you feel it, you process it, you also in the brain, what happens is that very, very rigid neural networks become unstable through conscious feeling and thereby become correctable. And this is the moment, like in that liquid state, as it's also called, we can actually reassess certain experiences and we come to like a new understanding of the experience. And then disidentification happens. And very often people will very naturally come to a place of saying, okay, a part of me feels like that, or part of me feels like that. So very similar to what happens in IFS. And as I said, we don't really encourage people to strive for that. We much more encourage them to really become present with the very places they're avoiding because we found it to be more effective in the long term.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, it sounds like there's a kind of more natural release or disidentification when the time is right, rather than,
Yes.
because I see that, like it takes a certain level of awareness to disidentify in a way that's not bypassing, And it sounds a bit like the person that's really important. There's a partner there who is playing that role of, a kind of unconditional positive regard in a sense, and
Yes,
that's an
yes.
important part of the process.
Very important. I always emphasize, people always ask me, can't I deal with it alone? And I say, no. And it's really good we can't, because what we see is that it's bringing back community. People are really connecting through this practice on a profound level, and they're realizing, okay, we've become so independent of one another. We don't really need each other for anything anymore. But for this, finally, we need each other, and it's actually really good and healthy.
And that process where, so the person is sharing how they're feeling, Could you talk us through, like, if we almost expand out the process of how release starts to happen?
Sure. So first of all, like I said, we always work with the partner, and it's very important that we're very clear about who's holding space and who's processing. We don't mix those two, but what we do is that we switch eventually. So we always go into both roles. That's very important in the practice. So within one cycle, you get to go into like your darkest depths. And you get to go into your most enlightened part, if you want to put it very simply. And that actually completes a cycle in yourself, and you learn to become much more fluid in yourself between those different parts, which also makes you more confident in navigating your system. And then the second aspect is that we agree on a very clear time frame. So we always practice with a timer, and a typical session might be 5 or 10 minutes per person. And actually, the more experienced you become, the less time you need. So you might start with 10 minutes each, and then eventually you realize actually 5 is enough, unless you're working on something really big. And so you actually set a timer and you stick to it. That's another important part of the practice, that you really learn to go in and out. And the third really important aspect is that we agree on a special confidentiality, which is that whatever is shared in the space, like if you and I were to practice now, not only do we not talk about it with anyone else, but also you wouldn't ask me about it or comment on it afterwards. And that makes it super safe. Like it really just stays in the moment and it's done, it's complete. And the effect is quite amazing. And what we do then is like the person who's the space holder really goes into, they become very present, they really take a moment to center, to connect with their heart and to really go, like you say, in this positive regard, to really see the other person in their best light and to see that in their own way, this person has always done their very best, even if it often seemed really inadequate. But there's a place in our hearts where we can really see that and we can really see the unique beauty of this being. Yeah, so we go there and we really offer a space of compassion to this being. And that's it, basically. We stay there for the agreed time frame, and we don't comment, we don't nod, we don't stroke, we don't do anything. We're just there. We're just the space of compassion, allowing the other person to really find their own path. And the other person has a space to feel the things that they can't feel when they're alone, or they're not willing, or they haven't been able to. And what happens through this space of compassion, actually, you're able to feel things that you couldn't feel alone. It's quite amazing. So typically, we might go into practice when we're actually emotionally activated, when we're really triggered by something, and we use the safe space to really become vulnerable and go to those parts that are hurting, to feel them, to sometimes voice them. Sometimes we also just allow them to move through the body, through voice without words. And this is really where each person needs to find their own way, and you need to kind of find it in you every time. It's not like you've found it once and then that's it. And of course, there is a kind of a learning that happens. So what happens, for example, I might go in and I might be really, really triggered by something that my partner said. And it might even be that I don't really know what it is. It often, very often when we're triggered, it's like a tiny thing, right? And we don't even know what it is. Or we don't even know what it's about. And we can go into the practice and really kind of follow that feeling. I call it the path of feeling. And it's going to lead us to like deeper layers. And very often we're going to have images surface, memories surface of times when it felt exactly like this. And this might be from past relationships, it might be a situation from childhood. And that original event, which is kind of like a layer deeper in that emotional package, will come up to be felt and released. And the amazing thing, and one of the greatest secrets for me to discover about emotional healing, is that healing happens through feeling, through conscious feeling. And for me, that was one of the greatest discoveries because, like a lot of people, I usually try to avoid that, right? I didn't want to feel that stuff because it was painful. And So I tried everything possible to get rid of it, right? You try to meditate, you work out, you, I don't know what you do, but there's a lot of different strategies we have to avoid healing and then to discover, well, actually, if I have the right environment and the right support and the courage to feel, whatever is there actually transforms very quickly. And healing happens at an incredible speed. Like it's within minutes that when you're really there and you access it and you have the space and you're allowed to move, I've witnessed such profound healing within minutes in my own system and in other people. The transformation that I was often working for or thought I was working for years. And that was quite astounding for me. And that's actually like at the heart of conscious release. So what will happen is, like I said, very often you're gonna have a memory surface, you're gonna feel that. Very often, then you will have tears, you will have shaking, you will have different ways that release can happen. Sometimes also laughter. And then after that, when you allow that, and that takes practice to not allow that, you end up in a very natural reevaluation of the situation, and you find like a new peace, a sense of calm, and you end up kind of in that transpersonal space much more that your partner is holding for you, and you end up having much more of that perspective. And very often you will have a new assessment, not only of your current situation, but also of the original hurt that you're processing. Kind of like you're connecting that with your adult consciousness, with your wisdom, and you realize, oh my God, like my mom, she didn't mean to hurt me. She was just completely overwhelmed, for example, just to use a really commonplace example. And that provides closure to the original experience, and it allows us to harvest also the growth, the development, the wisdom, the maturity that we could have gained from the experience if we had processed it right away.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. I feel like this is one of the moves of our time and really goes back to where you started, really, with a lot of spiritual practitioners, that this kind of process can help us build. I mean, this is a metaphor, but the right kind of energetic structure for these more transcendent qualities to really land and become something embodied. As we're doing this integrative work, so to hear about the journey, of there's some kind of trigger or difficult experience, and then we can be with our experience in a certain way that allows some kind of transformation, some kind of realization, and then we land in that place where, suddenly we're experiencing life from a different quality of being. I think that journey is really significant, and so it has me want to ask about a certain kind of attitude that's supportive inside of this practice. Is it, you said we have to learn our way through it, and I get that it's not like an intellectual thing, it's a full being thing or somatic thing. So is there a certain kind of attitude of learning to allow things to be and allow things to emerge, and trusting, if you feel something, then something else emerges? What's that kind of internal journey like?
So one of the things I like to say about the practice is that it's very quickly explained, and it can take years to really master. So I like to compare it to meditation, right? I can explain meditation to you in like 20 seconds, and then you can be busy for a couple of decades, like getting the hang of it. And the practice of conscious release is kind of similar. Like you can go deeper and deeper, and especially in the beginning, like it can take a while to get the knack. And many people, when they come to learn the practice, they realize that they've never really felt. They don't know how to feel. They realize that all their life they've been thinking their feelings or just avoiding them. And that in itself is a profound realization and a big starting point for people. And then to kind of go into this inquiry of like, okay, what is feeling? What is actually feeling? And not to assume that I know. Because, like I said, the places that we're going here are the places that we usually avoid at all costs. So it's like we've been running from this thing all our life, and suddenly you're in this practice and you're asked to stop and to go there. And it's not even like in a meditation where you're asked to stop and look and then like disidentify and be in this blissful state. No. I'm asking you to stop and go to the place where it hurts. And that takes a lot of courage. And then what you need is like you need a process where you can slowly build trust and you can have start to have the first experiences of that actually working, right? Of like, I'm telling you to go into the fire and you're like, no way. And then you go for the first time and you realize, oh my God, that's the place of healing that I've been looking for so long. And every time you have that experience, it becomes easier, obviously. And then one of the things that we have in our community is that we're now lucky to have a lot of experienced practitioners. So just practicing with them, there's kind of like a lot of information in the field about this already. So we have new people coming in, and suddenly they have this amazing experience of conscious feeling, and they don't even know what hit them because it's kind of becoming more available in the field of practice. So that's very helpful. And the other thing is that, like we said before, the role of the supportive person is very, very important. And they really, that compassionate attitude, that completely non-judgmental attitude, also this attitude of like, okay, this is your space and you can do with it whatever you want. Like it's your space to explore. It's your space also to get lost in, to kind of mess up. You know, it's not about doing it right. It's really about getting to know your system, trying different paths and really learning. It's this attitude of inquiry is really helpful. It's like, what is feeling and how do I feel in a way that allows healing to happen, that allows me to integrate all these parts that have been split off? That's kind of the basic attitude, I would say, that I try to encourage in people and that I've found to be most supportive.
I find that fascinating to hear about how it's becoming more accessible. And I get curious about that, you know, that is there something, of course, what's being transmitted basically, you know, like there's something being transmitted either by the experienced practitioners. Maybe it's also something more generally collective than that that's occurring, but and so just staying on that sense of feeling and practice that people have, it's like so they I mean I'm just curious if you could like offer an example of like how someone might follow a thread, you know, in a session, like if anything comes to mind, like someone comes in maybe with a certain trigger moment and then how they might be with, yeah, if you could. Do you have an example of?
Yeah, I'm happy to share an example. It's very hard to make these things up because they become very flat. It's much better to tell real life examples. So one of my favorite examples is from my own life where it happened years ago that I was doing the dishes and I was doing them quickly. So what happened was that the handle of the pan was still greasy. So I'd kind of like just taken it, washed it, rinsed it, and put it away. And my partner was not happy about that at all. And it triggered him. So he came and he like pointed out that the panhandle was still greasy.
Many
And
people are
that
nodding
triggered me.
in recognition of this type of interaction. Sorry to interrupt,
Yeah,
but
yeah,
it's
yeah.
so universal, kind
It is, it is.
of
That's
like.
why I love it. So what happened was then actually that triggered me, and neither of us was like majorly triggered. This was not a big thing, right? It was small, but it was there. And we were both at the time already practicing since a couple of years, so we were actually in a place where we could practice together, even though we had triggered each other, which is only for advanced practitioners. Let me emphasize that. But we sat down and we decided to practice and to see what was going on. And I don't even know what was going on for him, but for me, it turned out to be, it led me to one of the mo like core issues of my life. Like I went from this place of like, okay, someone is pointing out a mistake that I made, And I came in touch with a place in me that insisted that I should be allowed to make mistakes. Now, this phrase of like, I should be allowed, is very significant. It's something I talk about in my books a lot. It's something I call an absolute. An absolute is a very particular kind of belief where we believe that, or we insist that something should be different than it is. And it's very subtle to distinguish that from, I want it to be different. No, no, no. We say it should be different. So that's what I encountered. I encountered an absolute. I also looked for it because I knew, like, at a certain level in the practice, you know to look for them because that's where we get stuck in our emotional healing. So I looked for that and I encountered this absolute, like, I should be allowed to make mistakes. I should be allowed to be imperfect. And what I did was then, because these absolutes, they actually protect like certain parts in us. So I spent some time feeling that and feeling into what's underneath that. And that brought me, and this was really within minutes, okay? This was like a 5-minute session, brought me to this deep place of, am I okay as I am? And am I okay to be here on this planet as I am? Like, it brought me to that profound existential question. And for me, that was like, wow, you know, how do you go from a greasy panhandle within 3 minutes to like one of your most existential life questions and find healing? Like, I found a profound release in that. And I realized that under that absolute of like, I should be allowed to make mistakes and be imperfect, there was just this really deep longing and wish to just be okay, to just be allowed to be here as I am. So that's like an example of a journey that for me was really profound and really shifted something in my sense of self. And it started from a tiny trigger that we could have easily glossed over. And without the experience in the practice, I certainly wouldn't have had that harvest, obviously. And yeah, that would be one example, a very personal one.
Yeah, beautiful. I think the example, thanks for sharing that, like what it speaks to as well is the kind of plasticity, the proficiency that can develop as one gets, you know, proficient at this kind of way of being with ourselves. Like it doesn't need, sounds like it just doesn't need to take long time. I mean, if things have their own process, it takes as long as it takes, but that actually, things can speed up and these transformations can unfold quite quickly.
They can. And that's one of the most astonishing things. Like what I recommend to people, I recommend to practice every day, but to really just practice for 5 minutes, kind of like brushing your teeth. I call it emotional hygiene. You invest 5 minutes a day. And what happens is that on some days you're going to be like profoundly triggered. And on many days you won't be. And there won't be a lot happening. It'll just be a space of connecting with yourself and affecting your day and just kind of, you know, feeling into yourself. But what happens is that your system kind of becomes proficient at that and develops kind of a routine and familiarizes itself with the space and learns to trust it. And what I found in myself, and I've heard from many others, when they really do that consistently for a while, after about 10 months, very often something really profound opens up. And they find that suddenly, within minutes, they can release issues that they've been carrying their entire life. Like the kind of stuff that many people report they haven't gotten through in coaching or therapy, because it's always that one session and then a week later it's another session. But there's something about that really minute chipping away and consistency and regularity that really helps people. And that said, I want to emphasize, of course, it's not necessarily something that I recommend people to do instead of therapy. Very often, if people need therapy, it's a great idea that they do therapy. But many people find that it actually complements their therapy or their coaching. I also hear, I mean, I train many therapists and coaches, and they find they're so relieved because they can teach this practice to their clients and let them do that. And then they can actually focus on the big stuff in the coaching and in the therapy. And they don't have to like spend all that precious time just, you know, listening compassionately, trying to walk through people's feeling if that's what they do. And they found that it makes their work much more effective.
This brings up a bigger question I want to ask you, but just first want to check. So you have people do that for 5 minutes a day. Is that by themselves, like just, or is that the paired practice again but with others?
Yes, always with a partner.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. My bigger question then is, it feels like, and this is part of the question to you, like that. Like one of the things I see emerging in coaching, this is a big theme on the podcast, is like a shift from like an older paradigm of like self-development, often coming out of a place of lack. And it kind of can have this sort of sense of like, I need to develop myself and get to a place where I'll be okay. You know, it can masquerade inside, I need to do my healing or my developmental work. But inside of it, there's this fundamental sense of feeling fragmented and lacking. And what I see emerging around the world now, even in practices like circling and we space practice everywhere, is like this fundamental attunement to attunement itself. You know, to being with my experience, not just conceptually, but felt sense, cultivating felt sense experience. And I think this taps into our previous podcast as well about transrational ways of knowing. But we're spending time to expand our spectrum of where we feel from, to feel our felt experience, and instead of trying to get somewhere, we're just including, embracing, being with what's here as it is. And as we do that, there's a kind of, we activate this kind of transformational mode of consciousness where it begins to integrate and reveal more. It unfolds rather than, and that's a fundamental practice, like that you can be applied in so many places. And I wonder how that resonates with you. And it sounds like that's, aside from the integration work, that's a kind of like almost like a meta competency that people are developing through coming back to this every day.
Yes, definitely. And it's very interesting. Like originally when people come to like an emotional backpack workshop, or they read the book or they do the online course, very often they will come from a place of suffering or deficiency, like because they can't feel themselves. Like not everyone comes because they suffer emotionally. A lot of people also come because they suffer from being numb and they can't feel. Or they have a lot of drama in their lives. So they certainly have something going on an emotional level, usually. But what happens then after a time of consistent practice, very often they will come back to me and they were like, well, actually, you know what? I find that I'm no longer in that state of suffering, like all the time. Like it's actually becoming the exception rather than the rule. And I find that I'm much less in drama. I find my thoughts are calmer. I find that there's a lot of space inside of me now. And sometimes it's almost like, okay, and now what? And this is very interesting because what I see is that sometimes people will like, in German, they will like read the Inner GPS, my book on transrational thinking. They will read that before they have done their emotional work, and it's kind of like intellectually interesting and they like want to go there, but they can't ground it. And then they do the emotional work and then they kind of come to this, okay, now what? And I'm like, okay, now you need the Inner GPS. Because now there's the space from which this emerging can actually happen. And it's not just a theoretical framework, but it's like an experiential framework. And it's like something where you are guided and you're going to need guidance to learn to work with that guidance. So the two really connect. And it's just that sometimes people try to skip the emotional work because it's just not so attractive. So many people, like I said, who come for the emotional work, they do come up from a place of lack. And then once they're out of that place of lack, then they're like, okay, what do I do with my life now? Yeah. And then I'm actually like, okay, so actually the emotional work is just preliminary work. And I say that a lot to people. I say, like, actually, I'm not that interested in emotional work, which is odd for people because often I'm like considered an emotional expert. But actually, it's preliminary work. It's like a prerequisite for the real work. And the real work is about like connecting to that deeper place, developing that, first of all, mature sense of self, and then even a transpersonal sense of self, like that whole journey. But in order to be able to do that authentically, we need to first do the emotional work, and then we can engage with that deeper place.
Amazing. I want to ask you about that in a moment. There's one question I want to ask before I go there, and I want so otherwise I'll forget. And in one way, it's a reflection, and the other question is about AI, because like what strikes me about what you've created here is that, like, you've kind of created a standardized practice, that you set a timer. There's two people. There's specific roles, and what I like about that is it becomes more scalable. And that's really fascinating to me. Like it because yeah, like you said, working with a coach or a therapist, you don't. It's more cost prohibitive. So that's what one thing I really like. There's a kind of democratization of the practice, which can spread. And that had me thinking about what your thoughts are about AI playing that partner role. It's a big conversation now inside of coaching, as there are many coaching AI coaching bots appearing, and they're only going to get more and more sophisticated. And people are saying, hey, all the kind of formula-based approaches to coaching will be done by AI better than humans. And so in one sense, that will accentuate even more the mystery and the miracle of being two humans in connection. The more I've seen of these coaching bots, the more so far I've been like, oh, okay, yeah, it's cool.
What's the end? I want to hear it.
It's in a way I'm answering my own question. It's like well, one thought I had was like, what there's the transmission of being human missing. There's the human to human connection. And transmission can sound very esoteric, but and sometimes I mean it in that way, but I also mean it in just like there's just this felt resonance of being with another human being, and that might be the gift of AI, that it actually has us recognize that even more, because we're like, fuck, there's something like fast food, junk food, like feeling of like, anyway. So I don't want to talk so much. So just curious what you think about all this.
Yes, I'm happy to talk about it. I did do a YouTube video on this. Unfortunately, it's only in German. So yeah, my take on AI, and I've talked about this for a couple of years now. There's something interesting in the history of AI, which I don't know if you're aware of. And this goes back to like the really, really, really early days of AI when they were like talking about this in the 1950s at MIT. And Marvin Minsky was saying, like, yeah, by the 1970s, we humans can be really lucky if we can like kind of do service jobs for the robots. Well, that didn't really work out, right? And the reason why it didn't work out was that they had completely overlooked the role of feeling and thinking. Like at that time, they still thought that thinking, rational thinking, was completely separate from feeling. And that, of course, was a really gross misconception. And Marvin Minsky ended up writing a whole book about it called The Emotion Machine. And only once they had like integrated that aspect were they able to kind of come up with something that resembles human intelligence in some limited form, which is where we are now. And I think that story really proves your point, right? Like through like trying to build something, like we're trying to rebuild us in a way. And through that, we're kind of discovering all the things we are, right? So we kind of, I mean, we've built machines that like take over manual labor, and now we're building more and more intelligent machines that take over like mental labor. And a lot of that, has done us good. Not all of it has done us good, obviously. Some physical labor and some mental labor are not so bad for us after all. But one of the things I'm seeing, or I'm also very interested in right now is the whole transrational aspect and this ability of hu for humans to connect to what I call the inner order. That is something uniquely human, and I suspect that pretty soon we're going to discover that. And like to pick up your point, speaking of the practice of conscious release, that is something that cannot be done by an AI bot, because there is something in the practice of space holding where there is an actual, you call it transmission, let's just call it connection resonance. There's something that happens where the connection between the two fields enables you to feel something that you couldn't feel alone. And an AI bot cannot generate this kind of field. It cannot, as of now, generate a heart space. It cannot. So it can like give the right cues and say the right things, but in this practice, we're not speaking. So it's not about the words. It's not nodding. It's not any of that. It's a space. And you know, maybe one day this will be recognized, and we'll try to build a machine that can do that. I'm not that interested, obviously, but I think the questions that it brings up and the kind of mirror that it presents us with is rather fascinating.
Yeah. And I do want to acknowledge, I don't want to come across as just anti AI and these, I do hear that it's having positive impacts on people, even therapeutically. And I'm curious about when they become more and more humanoid, so it won't be long until you can talk to a human, exact like human looking AI entity, and it will be able to tell your emotional state and respond to you, and it will seem human, and in it, and what does that seeming human afford in terms of our development and healing? So, I want to stay really humble about that too. And, there is this whole side of it which we've just discussed. And there's many pitfalls perhaps of starting to develop wisdom in relationship to AI and machines, So anyway, so that's a big topic. And it actually brings up again this question of, well, you said inner order, that was a phrase that caught my attention. And earlier you said about this deeper place, this kind of transpersonal self. So, I'm hearing that through the students you have, or the people using this conscious release process, and in your kind of lineage, that actually over time they start to then do the integration that allows them to mature and begin to access transrational ways of knowing and access this deeper place. Could you say more about that and what the inner order is, and even what transrational ways of knowing are and stuff like that? Yes, and how we can
I
connect
mean,
them to emotional work.
yeah, we can talk about it briefly. I mean, we spoke about it extensively in our last talk, so maybe we can also refer people to that. I think that would be good. I also wrote a whole book about it. It will be released, I hope, within the coming months, so we'll keep you posted. The it's called Your Inner GPS, and there's a whole model that I developed, which we talked about last time, right? About the different ways of transrational knowing. Just to give that context and just say, you know, we can just touch on a few points. So transrational ways of knowing is what opens up once you've managed to calm your mind and to clear up your emotional baggage. You become more attuned to the subtle signals in your system, and those include your intuition, your heart intelligence, your inspiration, your intention. And then the challenge is how to allow, how to let them work well with your rational mind, right? Because in most people, the rational mind or semi-rational mind is kind of super dominant. and is trying to do everything, and it's not really good at everything, and it needs to kind of learn its place with the transrational ways of thinking, which is what I call them. And that's a whole development process that comes once we've done our emotional homework. And of course, it's not completely like sequential. Like you do your emotional homework, and then there's moments when you're not actually completely triggered and you're centered, and you're actually able to feel yourself, and then you can already start to navigate your life with the transrational ways of thinking. And many people do that anyway without ever having heard about this concept. Like, it's not like I invented it. I'm just trying to describe a phenomenon that I see developing. And so inner order, this is a term that I like to use. It's inspired by David Bohm's work on the implicate order. I don't know if you're familiar with it. I'm sure many people will be. So he proposed that, kind of to complement the explicate order that we can perceive, there's an implicate order in the universe. I mean, he's a physicist, of course, before he did his work on dialogue. And he proposed this as a way of explaining a lot of things that current physics and science actually cannot explain, like how does Newtonian physics and quantum physics fit together? They don't. And implicate order, his model, like, very beautifully describes from a like physicist scientific perspective kind of what I experience, or my perception of reality and what I was trying to describe. So I kind of borrowed the term and use it. So use inner order for that level of reality where everything is connected and one, and the entire universe is one movement unfolding. And you and I in this conversation is part of that movement, is an expression of that movement. And externally, you and I may seem separate, but internally we know that everything is connected. And through meditation and other practices, we can access those states of consciousness where we can actually experience that, and we can have practices that help us to reconnect to that knowing. And transrational ways of knowing or thinking actually help us to navigate our life from that deeper place, from inner order, so that we become more attuned and also more interested in, okay, how does life want to express itself through me now, rather than what do I want and how can I control the universe to be as I please. So that kind of changes our dialogue with life, you could say, and our role and our understanding of ourselves. So the emotional work is a prerequisite for that. That's one way of putting it.
Yeah, I can imagine. Curious what you think of that. Before we've done our emotional work, there's a bigger backpack, or I don't know if that's the right way to describe it, but we're going to get buffeted around more. This old conditioning, these parts, there's just more of them they haven't been related to. So the more we do that work, there's more integration taking place, and it's like we're sensitizing or accessing more of this inner order that you're talking about, where maybe we're like purifying or clearing fragmentation. And I'm curious about that, and in a sense, like this sense of so in that process. Like, I know my own journey of that led to also a sense of deepening intimacy with experience. That many of these older parts and the fragmentation was protective, basically. It was there to kind of protect me, but in that protection created less intimacy, increased that sense of separation. So the more integration allowed like almost metabolized that fragmentation and allowed for a kind of intimacy with experience, which goes deep, like you're pointing to. It's like it's not just like romantic intimacy, although I think Eros is a big part of it, but yeah, so not quite sure if there's a question in there, specific question, but like, I'm just curious how that resonates with your own experience.
It does. And maybe there is another discernment we can make. I'm going into this conversation, I mentioned that I'm looking forward to writing the next book, and I don't know if it's the next or the one after that, but certainly one of them is going to be about this journey from ego to a healthy, mature sense of self, to a transcendent sense of self. And what we're talking about with conscious release is very much this journey from our unhealthy ego, which is how I use the term, to like a healthy sense of self. So the feeling powers, the healthy anger, the healthy sadness, the mature fear, etc., they're all connected to like a healthy sense of self. And this is where we're able to be vulnerable, we're able to relate, and we have a much higher capacity for intimacy. And in the egoic state, we're very much in this protective mode that you refer to. And the distinction I want to make in this book is that, yes, there's that development when a lot of psychology deals with that. And then there's the development to a transcendent sense of self. And that's where kind of the inner GPS comes in, where we become less and less interested in like, okay, what do I want and how do I get it? But we become much more interested in like, okay, so how does life want to express itself through me? Like, how does the universe want to move right now? And that's a very different question. And we develop something like transpersonal will, where we have moments where we feel like something wants and we can't say, I want. Like if I would ask you, what do you want? You would say, well, I just want to sit on the couch and watch TV. But there's another part that says, no, actually, I need to do this Coach's Rising thing, you know? It's not what I want, but it's like life wants it, right? And there comes a certain place in our development where we experience that. People experience that kind of thing. And so there is an intimacy. The reason why I brought it up is because that in that healthy sense of self, there is a beautiful intimacy that becomes possible with ourselves, with our needs, with our vulnerability, with our feelings, with our beloveds, our children, with our friends. It's very personal, right? But it's mature, it's safe, it's beautiful. And then when we go into the transpersonal self, there is like another intimacy, which is kind of the intimacy with the universe, with the sacred. And then it becomes transpersonal. And we actually sometimes, when we're really in that, we feel like it's almost like we lose that personal intimacy because we're just so not identified, right? Sometimes we can go into those states when we go into deep meditation or through ritual or other experiences, we can do that as well. And that's kind of something I want to map, right? Because what I experience in myself and in many people is that we actually go back and forth between these states, and we develop them. And it's not like we're constantly living in one. It's like we can be thrown back to the ego state when we're emotionally activated, or we can like go on a profound meditation retreat and come out like completely transpersonal, and then we're thrown back. And you know, like it's this whole journey. And so that's a distinction I would like to offer in terms of intimacy, because there's like different kinds of intimacy we're talking about here.
No, I think that's I really appreciate what you did there, building on my reflection on intimacy. And then I just come back to this idea of like the same, like what are these core practices or moves, you know, like this one of consciously releasing or relating to emotion and felt experience, and how that can deepen into these transrational ways of accessing experience and this inner order. So this has been really rich. And I just want to ask one last question, which might bring up another one, but which is in a sense of like how you're making sense of the world right now, you know, with everything that's unfolding, and, you know, maybe even in the context of this emotional backpack work, man, it seems like we could do with a lot of that around the world. So I know it's a huge question, but just curious where that takes us.
Yeah. It's an important question. It's a very important question. For me, the context of my work has really shifted in recent years. A lot of my work used to focus on kind of like trying to prevent the worst, you know, trying to have us turn back from the cliff we're heading to. And I feel we're past that point. I feel it's no longer about that. So realizing that has for me, turned my attention much more to hospicing and midwifing. So hospicing the old and possibly midwifing something new. And one of the things that helped me to make meaning, and this is not like in the sense of like I'm trying to make this up, but I feel this deeply, is that we have always needed crisis in order to evolve. This is something that's been true, not just of our species, but of any species, probably. Like that's how we evolve. And it's kind of like the shift in consciousness that's needed to prevent the crisis actually needs the crisis in order to come about. So it's kind of a chicken and egg problem. And I really don't know how bad it needs to get before we shift. I see a lot of people are shifting. I mean, I see a lot of shift in consciousness and clearly not enough. I mean, right now, we're heading into darkness, like collectively, you could say. And yes, there's a lot of light also. And at the same time, I feel it is an important time to acknowledge this. And I've really shifted a lot of my attention to assisting people, developing community, developing practices, developing offers to help people make sense of this and help people use this personally and collectively in order to evolve. Because I feel that's what's needed. And the whole focus on actually assisting people through crisis has become really central to my work. But not just assist them through crisis so that they can get through crisis. That is not an end unto itself, but assisting them through crisis so that the crisis can actually become fruitful. I feel that's what we need. And that's what I'm really focusing on. And what the practice of conscious release really helps people do. In fact, the first lockdown was a very important point for us as a community. That's when we started our first online space that's still going on. Still twice a month, we have a public, like gift-based space that anyone can come to. They can learn the practice. They can practice. And that was like the starting point of our community. And it really showed that people need community in order to get through this. We need to pull together. We need to open our hearts to each other. We need to connect. We need to remember a lot about what it means to be human and take the time for that. And I see that's happening out of necessity and will probably need to happen more. Yeah.
I love, first of all, I can just feel the resonance of like you naming like your sense of where we're at and how that resonates with me, the sense of hospicing, and it kind of puts me in touch with a sense of grief, a sense of loss, and same time there's a kind of sweetness in it too. It's like not just, it's like a bittersweet feeling. And I think I'm in touch with like my own journey these last few years of like similar to you, like where it's like, oh, not, we're not, it's not, we're not going to avoid something now. It's like, yeah, this is happening. And actually, there's a chance we won't make it, but yeah, what you said about the crisis itself will get as big as it needs to, in conjunction with our refusal to, to not acknowledge things and transform. So what I guess what I'm trying to say is like that, whilst I've had periods of feeling overwhelmed with grief, I find myself like tenderized and loving the small moments more than ever. And that's such a gift. I imagine it's a bit like when people have a terminal illness, and you read about how like they suddenly appreciate life in a way that they didn't before that, and have a similar feeling, which is kind of like allowing me to feel a weird kind of hope, because again, we hope we might associate with like we're going to avoid something. Or and I guess I'm naming all this because of the importance of the practice we've talked about today, with like Not avoiding that feeling of grief and loss, but actually turning towards it as being essential. Like, so that's just why I wanted to share that piece.
Thank you so much.
Where can we find out more about your work, Vivian? Yeah, this has been a really rich conversation for me. And where can we find
Well,
more?
we're just in this very exciting process of finally making more of my work available in English. This is something people have been asking for years. And yeah, so much is happening in the German-speaking world that my team and I were just barely able to keep up. And now finally we have a team in place that is handling that. So we have now brought up out the emotional backpack. You can go on vivianditmar.com. You can find out about the emotional backpack book. We have an online course. There's a newsletter you can sign up. You can stay posted. We'll let you know when the inner GPS is available as a book and other books. We plan to also re-release edit an edited version, retranslated version of The Power of Feelings, and also my latest book, True Prosperity, which is very much about like a new vision for life, what it means to live a good life as a human being. Because I feel we've gotten lost on on a false definition of prosperity, and that's gotten us into a very bad place. So I'm very, very excited to finally share this with the English-speaking audience, and I'm really thrilled that you invited me again for this conversation, Joelle. So I really hope many people will be inspired to check out what we're doing, and because so many people have really found it profoundly helpful, especially in these times. And yeah, I just really want to share it. So thank you so much for supporting me in doing that.
Yeah, true pleasure. Yeah, honestly. Yeah, thanks, Vivian. Here we are, we're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com, put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.